Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
So today on Fresnolandia, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about Thanksgiving this year, and we're titling this episode Surviving Thanksgiving, because a lot of us are going home to people that we both love and have different points of view than us, and Thanksgiving dinner table has become a metaphor for the breakdown of civic dialogue in America, and we think we need to work on that as a society. We're seeing increasing polarization, and so we have a few different topics that we're going to cover today, and Donnie and I are going to just discuss our points of view, and also we're curious yours. So we're going to start with a big picture question here, which is, why is Thanksgiving so hard? Why do you think it's so hard, Donnie?
First of all, people that you only encounter maybe once or twice, three times a year.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stakes on this meal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's almost started to build up in like the collective psyche of America. Like now a lot of national magazines and publications have, here's how to prepare for your relatives. I think maybe this is the millennial publications that are starting to do this more, but like how to prepare for Thanksgiving. And so we've just seen it as a civic battleground. But I also think that there's been increasing pressure in certain circles of our society to see your family members as an opportunity to convert them to your perspective.
Yeah,
and I think that's also placed a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and I feel like when I was growing up, it was always like there was discussion about one weird uncle, but now it feels like much more fractious across the whole divide, because you have like generational divides, you've got political divides,
yes.
You've got lifestyle divides.
Yes.
You even got like when I went away to college in San Francisco, I came home a vegan, and the first Thanksgiving back, which is every parent's nightmare, there was a tofurkey on the table. And so that became like a metaphor for me changing my way of life almost immediately upon moving out of home. And so I think there's a lot. But what I hear a lot, and I'm curious your perspective on this, in the past few years, there's been a lot of discussion about this kind of Venn diagram between disagreement and harm, where ideas can be harmful, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is a little bit of this kind of reticence to even engage in topics because they could harm. So how do you see that difference between the boundary between disagreement and harm?
Ooh.
Yeah, this is a big one.
And you're just going all the way.
Yeah, we got to get started. Yeah, it's almost Thanksgiving. I got to go home and work on the stuffing right now.
Okay, I think that a lot of people see the line as, When do your political ideas interfere with my dignity, with my lifestyle, with my way of being? And classic example, if you are against gay marriage, is that just a purely ideological difference? We can still be friends. We can still be in relationship with each other. Or if you have a queer person in your family, does that actively cause harm if you don't believe that they should be able to marry? Now, I'm not a queer identifying person, and that's always been a debate that I'm not as, don't have a seat at the table at that debate, so to speak. But where I do have a seat at the table is on a woman's role in society. I have many family members who...
They're pontificating about contrary ideas to your own, how do you perceive that? How do you experience that?
Well, it depends. If they're pontificating about immigration, topics that I care a lot about, but it doesn't directly affect me, I still feel very passionate, and it takes a lot of energy in me to depersonalize it, to say they can have this view and to think of them in a complex way and to say you can have this view about immigration, but you're a complex person. You're allowed to exist in my mind in a complex way. But it really, where it divides for me is if your views are about immigration policy, that's one thing. How many refugees do we let into America every year? How many people, what should be our immigration rate? Those to me are legitimate policy questions. If you go down the path of dehumanizing, that's an automatic, I can't talk to you about this conversation anymore. If you're starting to say, immigrants are bad, immigrants are criminals, that's just it's a non-starter for me. But there are certain topics where I have multiple family members who don't think women should be in positions of leadership over men, full stop. Mm. I don't know how to have that conversation with them. Like, I will happily sit next to them at the Thanksgiving table. I will happily play my gender role of bringing a wonderful pie to the convening. And then if they start questioning my role in society, I'm going to be like, you can shut up now because give a damn.
I think what you're describing is the difference between like lizard brain takes and prefrontal cortex takes. If you're having an immigration discussion about policy, which maybe the Thanksgiving table isn't really the place for that anyway, maybe that could be addressed respectfully. But if someone's just like saying all immigrants are criminals and rapists, then you've entered a new territory where we're entering a territory of racism. And that's just, there's nothing that's productive that's going to come from that. And no. So I think, yeah, I think that's how I would distinguish. However, though, I do think there is, to push back on your point, there are people that see a lot of the cogent ideas as just coded,
yeah,
or like veiled racism in some ways. How would you respond to someone that said that?
I think that's sometimes true. It's, although it's becoming more fashionable these days to say the quiet part out loud, so that's maybe changing. But I think to a certain extent, if someone says something like, wow, we've really let too many immigrants into this country, while on its face, that's technically a policy question. How many people should we let in? It's a coded way of signaling that you're anti-immigrant.
Yeah.
So I understand why people might come to that conclusion. I don't, when someone starts a conversation with, man, too many immigrants in this country, I don't know how to take you seriously, because especially in our part of the country, immigrants are literally the backbone of our society. And so it's like a non-starter. But I think it depends. It's context specific.
Yeah.
Maybe.
What do you think about, and I think about this a lot because I try my best to engage with a lot of different kinds of people that have different kinds of ideas about the world. It's important to me. It's a core value for me. And so I often look at what people are saying as information rather than an attack on me or something. This tells me a lot about you. And so it's almost like a turn to curiosity. But I also understand that you just don't want to sit and listen to someone's diatribe at the Thanksgiving table. So I try to think in terms of I'm learning something from you by what you say. But do you think that's even valuable?
It can be valuable. I think that,
because we're not really curious about each other. We all have our informed opinions and we don't express any curiosity.
Yeah.
That's been my experience where people are just siloed in their little areas and they don't ask questions.
I think that in my professional life as a journalist, it is so much easier for me to be curious about other people with different perspectives of mine because the stakes are low. You're not at the dinner table with me. You don't know my kids. You don't know my life.
Yeah.
It changes the stakes if I am in personal relationship with you in some way. And I personally have a much harder time being curious with my relatives who know me personally than the ones who are just a person I'm interviewing for a story.
Now, we've now arrived at a situation, right? You're sitting at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Someone brings something up. You have a few different paths you can choose from this point. You can choose to avoid, change subject, or engage. What path would you choose personally at your dinner table if something's broached?
I wish I was the person that engaged because I want to be that person and I preach civil dialogue all the time. I think I am usually the person that's, wow, that was such a great green bean casserole.
Okay, so you're a change the subject.
I am. Or I lean into my husband who, weirdly, our roles reverse when we're in family situations.
Okay.
And he's way more willing to get curious with people than I am.
Okay. So does it work when you change subjects, you feel like?
Sometimes. I think it depends on who it's with, because again, it goes back to if I'm in relationship with someone, if our kids hang out all the time, if you're one of my siblings, if you're my parents, you know, where I've decided to keep you in my life, then I think, unfortunately, I've tried to create some sort of complexity in my mind about people, and changing the subject in some ways helps me keep the complexity. I'm not super proud of that. Like, yeah. I think I would like to do better engaging, but I like to engage on tough topics on my own terms and not at a 12-person table with my random uncle who's going to say crazy stuff no matter what.
It feels like it can only end poorly. You have to go to the bathroom, you're on the freeway, and there's a really strange truck stop, and you could get off there and wander into that strange bathroom, or you could just hold it and just keep going so you could get home as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And so I do something similar. I tend to engage humor as a distraction tactic.
Yeah.
I'm a court jester in my family.
That tracks.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that typically works for me because I can just say, let's talk about something we all right. align on, which I think is also a tactic that I would encourage because I think it's really easy to focus on differences. And I think this yeah. time is really not for that. It's let's talk about grandma and how much we miss grandma
sure.
or just kind of re-engineer the conversation to go to a good healthy place.
But you have to know your audience because I feel like my mom is a great example. My mom and I are not aligned on most political topics or theology, and theology is very big in my family. I have a very big Christian family, and so in a large group setting, that is not the place for my mom and I to go at it. But we are quietly building our arsenal of articles to engage.
That still blows my mind.
Each other
that,
on.
That even that's a practice in your family. That's crazy
and
to me.
I promise you, sometime this week, my mom and I will sit down. We'll have a glass of wine. My sister will probably join, and we will go at it for a few hours.
Wow.
But it's very respectful. There's a bending on both sides. There's okay. It's not a war of words. It's a war of ideas. And it's actually, I learned a lot about debate from my mom, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that's a great strategy. So we're going to assume now that, kind of per your last comments, we need to engage in a political conversation. It's unavoidable. We're trapped somehow. Or we just feel optimistic that we can make progress, or feel optimistic that it's a opportunity to build rapport with a family member, or even change someone's mind, which seems unlikely, but let's be Pollyannas for a minute. So let's talk about how to engage. What are the things, like to use the John Gottman horseman reference, what are the things to avoid when you're having a political conversation with someone? If we were thinking tactically, what is the best approach there?
First of all, never assume someone's perspective if they haven't said it. I think we often will take a bit of something someone said and then say, oh, because you said this, you obviously think this.
Okay. And so not categorizing.
Not falling into slippery
type.
Slopes. Yeah, I think it is the number one tactic.
Yeah. Okay. So
what about for you? You avoid.
What do I avoid? It's interesting. My family actually gets more engaged around religion topics than political topics.
Okay.
And so I tend to avoid definite statements about what I think. And so I tend to go interrogative and just ask questions because I think the questions both share what I think in the framing, but also avoid confining me to a spot, which maybe people view that as obfuscation, like trying to make things foggy when they don't need to be and being dishonest. But my objective in those conversations is more to learn. So I don't typically approach them by having some like debate style resolution. This is what I think. And then listing out why I think that. Let's say you're at the dinner table and someone shares something that's so clearly conspiracy theory, misinformation. It takes over the dinner table. We just had the Epstein release. So there's so much opportunity for social media information to enter our dinner table. What do you do in those scenarios?
I look at my oldest sister, and I give her the look that says, it is time. I am best employed as an instigator, actually.
Oh, okay.
A person coordinating other people.
Oh, okay. So you call someone off the bench.
So I look at Monique and I say, it is time. Or I look at my cousin Brooke and I say, it is time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm the coordinator.
Okay. So what does that look like after it gets started?
Yeah, I mean, if it's conspiracy theory, just, where did you get that information?
Okay, so you do media literacy
questions. Yeah, that's the best way to come at the conspiracy theorists.
Okay, because oftentimes we're coming at the dinner table and we, I don't know if we do this in the front of our minds, but we assume that we're all working with a similar pile of information, if you will. We are not. Absolutely not.
No.
And so it's almost, I think that's why it can be hard because it's like, I'm speaking German, you're speaking French. We're like almost talking different languages. And of course we're going to fight.
Yeah,
there's
gonna be Tower of Babel.
There's going to be total misunderstandings. Now, let's say you get into one of these exchanges and it devolves. We start getting escalation, emotions are running. Are there certain de-escalation tactics that have worked well for you that you think would be productive to share?
I think acknowledging, to the extent that this is possible, and it's not always possible, but to the extent that you could acknowledge that someone is making arguments in good faith.
Yeah.
To say, I can see how you might have that perspective.
How do you evaluate that?
Is it a dehumanizing perspective or is it not?
Okay.
I think
assuming goodwill and they're trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
I think it's always important to try to understand what's underlying someone's argument. Is it a concern about affordability? Is it a concern about safety? Is it a concern about scarcity?
Yeah.
When you get what's underneath someone's argument and acknowledge that the thing underneath the surface, it can lower the temperature.
Okay.
Now, if they're just taking pot shots that are racist at people, I don't really know how to work with that.
Yeah.
That's when I just walk away.
Yeah. That was going to be my next question about when to walk away. And I'll say before I go there, and being married to a clinical psychologist, I have a lot of like terminology that I will use sometimes to de-escalate, which often I don't think it's received very well. It comes across as condescending. Like, I see where you're coming from with those ideas.
That's not condescending.
No, I'm sure I have much more condescending ones to share. They're just not coming to my brain right now. Yeah. But that kind of, I'm above this conversation and I can see that it's not going well.
Therapy speak usually doesn't work very well.
It works terribly. But this goes back to our harm conversation a second ago. When there is a question as to, sometimes you're being challenged, and that's a good thing. And then sometimes you're being harmed. And so I think people tend to assume the harm really quickly and avoid those uncomfortable situations. And I think that's actually not good for you. Mm-hmm. I think you need to experience some of that discomfort, because I think, going back to our polarization discussion at the beginning, I think that's part of what's going on here, is we have lost how to productively disagree and learn from other people's point of view.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, or do you see it differently?
No, I do think that we've had a really hard time learning how to disagree. I think that as our world becomes more divisive, it's a rare skill set. I was certainly not taught how to disagree, because if you grew up in certain types of corners of the country where thinking was quite dogmatic, any sort of intellectual deviation was seen as an immediate threat, right?
Yeah.
And so when you're taught that thinking differently than the majority is a threat, then that it makes it difficult to learn civil dialogue in that situation. So I've had to unlearn a lot of the tactics that come along with that, so to speak. But it's incredibly helpful. I have a relative of mine who we've gotten in some debates over the years over school segregation, very hot topic, especially for white parents that are thinking about school choice and where to send your kids to school. It's very sensitive for a lot of people.
I have a lot of nice white parents in my life. Do you?
I am one.
Okay.
And that's a good plug for the New York Times podcast night. Was it called Nice White Parents?
Yeah, it's what it's called.
Yeah, it's a good
podcast where a group of well-intentioned families in brownstones takes over a small school and turns it into a dual language school, or alienating most of the current students. Anyway, continue.
Anyways, all of this to say, my debates with my relative about school segregation were formed by theory, not experience. And as you get older, you have more experience. And I think just like leaning into the experience and understanding what's underlying people's perspectives is helpful to bridge those gaps.
Absolutely. Our final topic here is, how do we leave Thanksgiving in a better place? If the goal of Thanksgiving in theory is to feel more connected to our family, or at least on paper, that's what it is. Do you think it's even worth getting into political discussions? Or do you think, which kind of undermines what we've been talking about, I think we're giving you a toolkit if it does happen, but if it didn't, that would not be such a bad thing. So do you think it's even worth having these kinds of discussions at Thanksgiving? Or are they reserved for other places?
I think it really depends on, you have to know your audience, right? My uncle, who is deeply ingrained in his Newsmax world, we're not going to have super productive conversations. But his wife, who was basically like an adoptive mother to me, even though we're on really different sides of the spectrum in a lot of ways, we can still have really loving, heartfelt conversations and come to an understanding. And I think you just have to know your audience. And maybe the 12-person table isn't the right place to do it, but I think the sidebars, that can be really productive, especially if you can break it down or have some interludes talking about your kids or football or...
Yeah. Look at some... Yeah, think about something else. Do you think it's fruitful to establish some kind of ground rules before Thanksgiving, or do you think that's maybe overthinking?
And if I tried to do that on my family, I would be immediately seen as the narc. yes. It's not for lack of trying to be that person at one point. I remember coming home from college one year and papering my parents' kitchen with a bunch of climate change stuff.
Okay, so that was your tofurkey.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And it's funny that you bring up the tofurkey, because I told my dad I would never become vegan, thinking that was like a peace offering. Like, I may be a person who thinks that we should not have climate change, but at least I'm never going to become a vegan. That did not do anything for him.
I'll believe strong things about the climate, but I'll never change your menu at Thanksgiving.
But every once in a while, I'll try to throw him like some red meat and be like, man, I just love red meat. And he'll be like, yes, okay, you are still related to me.
That's amazing. And I think the other thing that's a valuable thing over Thanksgiving is the ability to repair ruptures.
Yeah.
So if there is those moments to quickly repair and move on. I remember this was a subject that when you're a classroom teacher, they teach you with students that are misbehaving, not that our relatives are students misbehaving, kind of redirection or whatever tactic that just gets you on to the next thing because you don't want to disrupt class. And in this case, you don't want to disrupt Thanksgiving by making it like some kind of like deep emotional experience for you and your family around politics. It feels like you should probably do the minimal thing that will get you to the end of the meal, not getting off at that truck stop. So
I also just think that not that your goal should ever be to change your family's minds, because I don't think that if that is your end goal, that's usually a healthy starting point. Mm-hmm. Acceptance is like the number one rule, right? Like you have to, if these people are going to be in your lives and you have made that conscious decision, then like you have to accept whatever comes from that.
Yeah.
And if there is any sliver of hope that people might change their perspective after having a conversation with you, it's only going to be possible if they feel completely safe in your presence, and that they see you as a place to have open dialogue about things that might be controversial.
Yeah. And I often think too that our families and extended families and people that we spend Thanksgiving with, they're a microcosm of how you operate in society. And so it can often be good practice in a lot of ways to have these opportunities to engage and do it respectfully, because I think those are the kind of the virtues that we need to have a functioning democracy. And so I don't think it should be completely avoided, but I think it is an opportunity to put some of these ideas that we're discussing into practice. We conclude these podcasts each week with what we're loving this week. I'm going to start this week because I've got two things. Okay. Thing number one, and these are both snooty, snobby, whatever, just leave me alone. So every year I pay attention to who wins the Booker Prize. It's this book prize that comes at the end of every year. They have a long list and a short list. I try to read 1 to 2 books from the Booker Prize, and I just started the one that won. It's called Flesh by David Saloy, and he's like a Hungarian English writer, I think born in Canada. And the book is just basically follows this like hunky Hungarian guy as he like navigates through the world and rags to riches, weird stories. And it's really sparse prose. And as I was doing cleaning around my house to prepare for the holiday, I was listening to it and I got lost in it. It was like 2 hours later and I didn't even realize the time had passed and I was just fully absorbed. So there's some great books in there if you're looking for a novel to read. The other one that I'll recommend is my favorite holiday food influencer, Von Vreeland at the New York Times. Sorry, we were resting. It's just the New York Times day. He is hilarious. And every year he makes a dessert that I'm like so excited to make. And
what is it?
So the one that he did this year for Thanksgiving is a cranberry cookie butter cheesecake, which just sounds decadent almost, but looks incredible. It's no bake. You just make it the day before, put it in the fridge, and it's ready to roll. So I try to make one fun dessert every holiday, and that's what I'm choosing this year.
Ooh, I think I'm actually making a chocolate espresso pie.
Ooh.
Also from the New York Times.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about it.
We are not sponsored by them.
No.
Donnie, what are you loving this week?
So speaking of the New York Times.
Oh, God. We are nauseating. Sorry we're nauseating.
I know.
We can't help it.
I'm feeling very self-conscious
at the moment. We are who we are.
Yeah, exactly. I have a wonderful recipe from the cooking app for phony Negronis.
Oh, that's nice.
I've been trying to reduce my alcohol intake. I just feel much better as a person when I don't drink as much. So I've been making the phony Negronis, and it's like a hibiscus tea that you boil with orange peel and cloves and peppercorns.
Ooh la la.
And then you, after that steeps for a long time, then you mix it with grapefruit juice and some tonic. It is delightful.
Sounds incredible.
It's really good.
This week I am, speaking of drinks, I'm starting... So I always make my own eggnog every year. I mean, I do the slow approach where you put it, you like put all the stuff together. You don't cook anything and you put it in the fridge and leave it there for 3 weeks. And the alcohol takes away some of the more toxic elements of the raw eggs. And I'm like, when I put it in, like I know it's the holidays. And so I'm going to be doing it with my brother-in-law over Thanksgiving because he wants to join in and do this very unhealthy activity. And so we will be doing that this week. And I am so pumped.
Awesome.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.